stroked the rocks as hard as they could without showing any trace of foam. It is a compact, radiant, complacent sort of sea. Very beautiful. There ought to be seals. The waves themselves are almost seals today. But still I scan the water in vain with my long-distance glasses. Enormous yellow-beaked gulls perch on the rocks and stare at me with brilliant glass eyes. A shadow cormorant skims the glycerine sea. The rocks are thronged with butterflies. The temperature remains high. I wash my clothes and dry them on the lawn. I've been swimming every day and feel very fit and salty. Still no move from Lizzie, but I'm not worried. I feel happy in my silence. If the gods have some treat in store for Lizzie and me, good. If not, also good. I feel innocent and free. Perhaps it is all that swimming. How high-flown, almost pompous I'm becoming now that I am a prose writer. I know many playwrights who regard continuous prose as a sort of alien language which they could not dream of mastering. I think I may have felt like this myself at one time, and yet look at all the pages I've already covered. I've been looking back over my little sketch of James, and it is quite stylish. Is it true, however? Well, it is not totally misleading, but it is far too short and smart. How can one describe real people? James looks, in my description of him, so complete, so hard. I have omitted to say that he has little square teeth and an inane childish grin. Sometimes his mouth hangs vacantly open. He has a hooked nose and a dark complexion. Aunt Estelle was rather dark, too. Perhaps she had Red Indian blood. I must work harder on these portraits. Perhaps that is what this book will turn out to be, simply my life told in a series of portraits of the people I have known. What a funny, heterogeneous crew. Clement, Rosina, Wilfred, Sidney, Peregrine, Rita, Fritzy, Jean, Al Bull. I must write about Clement. She is the main theme. How mad and bad she became at the end when she had lost her beauty and was losing her wits, and what a bitchy old bore she was, telling the same scandalous, obscene stories over and over again. That terrible atmosphere in her flat, the smell of drink, the smell of tears and hysterics. Her deep, sonorous, drunken voice droned on in endless recrimination. Did I face it well? I think I did. Forgiveness and mercy were so ready to hand as soon as I knew that she was doomed. That sounds cynical. I always loved her. And we were rewarded. At the very end, we were both perfect. Poor Clement. That is a dreadful land, old age. I shall soon be entering it myself. Is that why I feel I need Lizzie? I am writing this the next morning. I was sitting writing the above late last night in my drawing-room when something very disconcerting happened. I looked up and was for a moment perfectly sure that I saw a face looking at me through the glass of the inner room. I sat absolutely still, paralysed by sheer terror. The vision was only momentary, but although I cannot now describe the face, very definite. Perhaps it is significant that I cannot remember the face. After an interval, of course, I got up to investigate. The new oil lamp is easy to carry, so I was not reduced to peering about with a candle, and of course there was nothing to be seen. I even walked round the house. I felt, I must confess, very odd. I went with a sort of deliberate slowness up the stairs to bed and took a sleeping pill. I thought I heard the bead curtain clinking in the night, but that is a natural phenomenon. A little wind has arisen today, and the sea is blue and white again. I have considered two possible explanations of my apparition. One is that it was simply a reflection of my own face in the blackness of the glass. But, unless I had unconsciously risen, I was sitting well below the level at which I could have been thus mirrored. Also, the face appeared rather high up in the window, and so, a further thought, must have belonged to a very tall person, or to someone standing on something. Only there is nothing to stand on, since I have moved the folding table in here. Another theory I shall check tonight. The window that gives on to the sea was uncurtained, and there was an almost full moon. Could I have seen the moon reflected in the inner glass? "Everything is full of gods," Cousin James once said, quoting somebody. "Perhaps I have been surrounded by little gods and spirits all my life. Only the magic of the theatre exorcised or absorbed them. Theatre people are notoriously superstitious. Now we are all alone together. Well, I have never gone in for persecution mania, and do not propose to start now. I must soon go over to the Raven Hotel to get some more wine. I think I will stop talking about ghosts and monsters in the Black Lion. Decided not to swim today. I have been out shopping. The shop keeps promising lettuce, but so far has had none. No fresh fish, of course. I found some more letters in my stone dog kennel. Nothing from Lizzie. A communication from Peregrine Arbelot, however. For lunch, made my heavenly vegetarian stew of onions, carrots, tomatoes, bran, lentils, pearl barley, vegetable protein, brown sugar and olive oil. The vegetable protein I brought with me from London. I add a little lemon juice just before eating. With that, it is very light, a baked potato with cream cheese. Then Battenberg roll and prunes. Carefully cooked prunes are delicious. Drain and add lemon juice, or a dash of orange flower water. Never cream. If anyone wonders at the absence of eating apples from my diet, let me explain that this is one case where I have spoilt my palate with an aristocratic taste. I can eat only Cox's orange pippins, and am in mourning apple-wise from April to October. I will transcribe as an introduction to him Peregrine's letter. "Charles, how are you getting on? We are all consumed with curiosity. No one admits to having been invited. But don't you miss us terribly? Perhaps you have sneaked back to live secretly in your new flat, not answering the phone and going out at night. Someone said your house was on a lonely, wave-washed promontory, but that can't be true. I see you in a cosy marine bungalow on the seafront. After all, how could you live without your liquidizer? I couldn't bear it if you had really changed your life. That is something which I have always wanted to do, but never could and never will. I shall die with my boots off, the bastard I have ever been. I have been drinking for a week after returning from hell, alias Belfast. Civilization is terrible, but don't imagine that you can ever escape it, Charles. I want to know what you are doing, and don't imagine that you can ever hide from me. I am your shadow. I think I shall come down and see you at Whitsun. Someone dared me to, and you know I can't resist dares. Various people would send their love if they knew I was writing, but of course it isn't love, it's insolent curiosity. Few are worthy of you, Charles. Is the undersigned one? Time will show. Shall I come and bring my swimming trunks? I haven't swum since our epic days in Santa Monica. Another theory is that you are not in England at all, but gone to Spain with a girl. To disprove which, you must write. Your shadow salutes you. Peregrine. It is after lunch. It is perfectly true that I miss my liquidizer, and I am sitting at my upstairs seaward window. It is cloudy, and the sea is a choppy, dark blue-grey, an aggressive and unpleasant colour. The seagulls are holding a wake. The house feels damp. Perhaps I am still depressed by last night's experience, which was, of course, a simple visual illusion. However, I will check about the moon, and at least I can write depressed and not afraid. There is nothing to be afraid of. Perhaps I shall make some notes for a character sketch of Peregrine. This will involve writing something about Rosina, and I would rather forget that lady. Well, autobiography cannot be self-indulgent fun all of the time. Peregrine, he detests being called Perry as much as I detest being called Charlie. Only people who do not know me call me Charlie. Is one of those who have a strong concept of the life they want to lead and the role they want to play, and lead it and play it at the expense of everyone, especially their nearest and dearest. And the odd thing is that such people can, in a sense, be wrong, can, as it were, miscast themselves, and yet battle on successfully to the end, partly because their victims prefer a definite, simple impression to the pains of critical thought. Peregrine, although in many ways a gentle kind of man, has cast himself as a noisy bear. This role-playing makes him stupidly careless of making enemies, whereas I think it shows a lack of professional skill to make unnecessary enemies in the theatre. or indeed in life. Peregrine is always blundering along. He lacks the meticulous quality of the true artist. I always had to terrorize him to get him onto the stage, sober. He has the makings of a fine actor, only he is too damn conceited and casual. There is a sort of slap-dash Irishry about him. He has too many off days. Peregrine is an Ulster Catholic who started out as a medical student at Queen's University, Belfast, and then ran away to the Gate Theatre in Dublin. He hates Ireland as only the Irish can hate it. He early abandoned religion for Marxism, then abandoned Marxism. I first saw him as the playboy. He was slim in those far-off days, and coveted his talents at once. He is now, since he parted professional company with me some years ago, going to seed as a fat, charming television villain. He knows what I think of his career. But we remain friends, and this in spite of the fact that I stole his wife. He has married again, equally disastrously, an ex-actress called Pamela Hackett, who has a little daughter by her earlier awful marriage to Ginger Godwin. Ah, where is he now? Why do people ever marry? Yes, well, I shall have to talk about Rosina, and maybe it will do me some good to write it all down. Not that I could write it all down if I wrote volumes. Rosina was a huge phenomenon. She was already married to Perry when I first encountered her. They met in America in some interval after I had first spotted him at the Gate. I was still fairly young, though becoming known as a playwright and as a director. Some further time must then have passed. How I wish I had kept a diary, since I started to pursue Rosina after a period when I had again been living with Clement. What a lot of energy in my life I have spent escaping from women. Rita Gibbons comes into that story too, so perhaps it was later still. Clement tolerated Rita and Lizzie and Jean, but she detested Rosina. Of course I lied to Clement, she lied to me, but various people made a point of keeping her informed. Rosina is, of course, Rosina Vanbrugh, and is probably the most famous person in this book, after me. Her real name, which she keeps secret, is Jones, or Davis, or Williams, or Reese, or something, and she is Welsh, with a French-Canadian grandmother. I was never in love with Rosina. I would like to reserve that phrase to describe the one single occasion when I loved a woman absolutely. Not dear Clement, of course, but I was certainly mad about Rosina. Moreover, when a beautiful, witty woman is passionate about you, you cannot but feel that she has the root of the matter in her. I'm not sure whether she was in love with me. A furious mutual desire for possession dominated the whole affair while it lasted. At one stage she certainly wanted to marry me, whereas I never had the slightest intention of marrying her. I simply wanted her, and the satisfaction of this want involved detaching her permanently from her husband. Clement, when younger, was probably the most beautiful woman I ever knew, but Rosina is the most stylish, the most gorgeously, adorably artificial. There was something factitious and brittle and thereby utterly feminine about her charm, which made me want to crush her, even to crunch her. She has a slight cast in one eye, which gives her gaze a strange, concentrated intensity. Her eyes sparkle, almost as if they were actually emitting sparks. She is electric, and she could run faster in very high-heeled shoes than any girl I ever met. She was, and is, a good actress and a very intelligent woman. These qualities do not always go together. She had a mixture of Celtic and Gallic good looks, with blue eyes and wiry dark hair and a big, moist, sensual mouth. God, how different kisses are. Lizzie's kisses were dry and chaste, yet clinging. Rosina's kisses were those of a tigress. Rosina had the fierce charm of the rather nasty girl in the fairy tale who fails to get the prince, but is more interesting than the girl who does, and has better lines, too. She was a good comic actress and excelled in rubbishy restoration comedy, a genre I have never cared for. She made a memorable Hedda Gabler, and a rather touching Natalia Petrovna in A Month in the Country. Unfortunately, she was never able to play Honor Klein. When I worked with her, I used to cast her against her type. I often did this successfully with actors. She was surprisingly good as La Présidente in Sidney's adaptation of Liaison Dangereuse. I never let her play Lady Macbeth, but Isaiah Mommsen did much later on, and it was a disaster. After I left her, Rosina lost her way for some time in silly films and television. I was glad. After I left her, I no longer wanted to see her name in lights in Shaftesbury Avenue, nor did I care to know who directed her.
La jalousie naît avec l'amour, mais ne meurt pas toujours avec lui.
The interval between possession and hell was short, though I admit it was wonderful. Rosina was one of those women who believe that a good row clears the air. In my experience, a good row not only does not clear the air, but can land you with a lifelong enemy. Rows in the theatre can be terrible, and I avoided them. Rosina more than once called me a coward for this. She liked rows, any rows, and she believed in loving by rowing. I began to grow tired. The golden bridge for the departing lover I have always, I hope, provided when it became necessary. Rosina, when she saw me cooling, had no such merciful contraption ready. She clung closer and closer, and screamed louder and louder. She was always insanely given to jealousy, even more than I was. How very much jealousy, the spectacle of it, the suffering of it, has been a feature of my whole life. I think now of something so different, but equally awful, my mother's silence after the departures of Aunt Estelle. In the end, we both became half mad. I remember my cousin James quoting some philosopher as saying that it is not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the world to the scratching of one's finger. Rosina and I reached a state, though I would not have described it as a rational one, where we definitely preferred the former. I remember Rosina once hurling herself downstairs in a fit of rage. On several occasions I was quite ready for her to jump out of an upstairs window, and rather hoped that she would. I came to feel, perhaps I always felt, again in the words of some Frenchman, elle n'a qu'une faute, elle est insupportable. Sometimes, even now, I wake up in the middle of the night and think, at any rate, thank God that woman has gone out of my life. Of course, when I left her, she never went back to Peregrine. I was intensely grateful to Perry, and indeed admired him for the way he behaved. Cynics said he was glad to have Rosina taken off his hands. I knew better. He suffered. I'm sure that he and Rosina had lived in a perpetual state of war, but many not unhappy couples do so. I think he loved her, though he probably came, as I did, to find her simply impossible. So there may well have been an element of profound relief in having the problem removed without his will. Later, he went out of his way to make quite a show of masculine solidarity. He remains very attached to me, and I value this. One result of his truly remarkable generosity and kindness was that although I saw objectively that I had behaved badly, I felt practically no guilt. This was because Perry never reproached me. Just as, on the other hand, I have always felt guilty about my chauffeur, Freddie Arkwright, because he once flew at me, and not because I had occasioned his resentment by keeping him waiting hungry for hours while I was guzzling at the Connaught Hotel. Guilt feelings so often arise from accusations rather than from crimes. I have been out picking flowers upon my rocks. I collected a fine mixed bunch of valerian and thrift and white sea campion. The campion has a very strong, sweet smell. I cannot stop collecting stones, and the trough is overflowing, even though I have put some of the best ones into my lawn border. This border looks a little quaint. I will have to see how I like it when it is finished. It is a good way to display the stones, but will the earth discolour their undersides? This morning I swam in the rain from the stony beach. The beach is about a mile from the house on the village side, so I took bathing trunks, but did not don them, as there was no one there. The rain had a quieting effect on the sea, making it smooth and pitted, almost oily. I had no difficulty getting out. I collected more stones. Then I went home and sat naked in the warmish rain on Min's Bridge and watched the glossy water running into the deep enclosure. Even on a calm day it runs in and out like a tidal wave. I was unable last night to check my theory that my ghostly face was a reflection of the moon since the sky was cloudy, but I feel sure now that it was an optical illusion and needs no further explanation. I occupied the little red room in the evening and lit the fire there. The chimney smoked again, perhaps because of the direction of the wind. As I rescued a spider running upon a half-burning piece of wood, I remembered my father. Since I came here, I have lived with naked flames for the first time for some years. Clement always loved an open fire. What a strange process burning is. How utterly and sort of calmly it transforms things. It is so clean as death. Shall I be cremated? Who will arrange it? Let me not think of death. So far I've been keeping my wood in the larder, only there is not enough space, and the floor is curiously damp. I might make the downstairs inner room into a fuel store. The driftwood is so beautiful, smoothed by the sea and blanched to a pale grey colour, it seems a shame to burn it. I set several pieces aside and admired the grain. Perhaps I shall make a collection of driftwood sculpture. It is after tea, and I am sitting at the drawing-room window, watching the rain falling steadily into the sea. There is a terrible grim simplicity about this grey scene. Apart from an iron-dark line at the horizon, the sea and the sky are much the same colour, a muted, faintly radiant grey, and expectant as if waiting for something to happen, as there might be flashes of lightning or monsters rising from the waves. Thank heavens I have had no more such hallucinations, and the extent to which I have forgotten what I saw persuades me that it was indeed an after-effect of that drug which I so foolishly took. Or did I really see anything which needs even this much of an explanation? I keep a careful watch upon the flattened, rainy sea, but no great coiling form comes rising up. No seals, either. It did, oddly enough, occur to me afterwards to reflect upon what the Black Lion yokels said about worms. Worm is an old word for dragon. Well, this is getting a little too picturesque. Dragons, poltergeists, faces at windows. And how restless this rain makes me feel. I reread my pieces about James and Peregrine, and was quite moved by them. Of course, they are just sketches, and need to be written in more detail before they become really truthful and lifelike. It has only just now occurred to me that really I could write all sorts of fantastic nonsense about my life in these memoirs, and everybody would believe it. Such is human credulity, the power of the printed word, and of any well-known name or show-business personality. Even if readers claim that they take it all with a grain of salt, they do not really. They yearn to believe, and they believe because believing is easier than disbelieving, and because anything which is written down is likely to be true in a way. I trust this passing reflection will not lead anyone to doubt the truth of any part of this story. When I come to describe my life with Clement Makin, credulity will be strained, but will, I hope, not fail. Since I started writing this book, or whatever it is, I have felt as if I were walking about in a dark cavern, where there are various lights, made perhaps by shafts or apertures which reach the outside world. What a gloomy image of my mind! But I do not mean it in a gloomy sense. There is among those lights one great light towards which I have been half-consciously wending my way. It may be a great mouth opening to the daylight, or it may be a hole through which fires emerge from the centre of the earth. And am I still unsure which it is? And must I now approach in order to find out? This image has come to me so suddenly, I'm not sure what to make of it. When I decided to write about myself, of course the question arose, am I then to write about Hartley? Of course, I thought. I must write about Hartley, since that is the most important thing in my life. And yet how can I? What style can I adopt, or master, worthy of such a sacred tale? And would not the attempt to relive those events upset me to some intolerable degree? Or would it be simply a sacrilege? Or suppose I were to get the wrong tone, making the marvellous merely grotesque? It might be better to tell my life without mentioning Hartley, even though this omission would amount to a gross lie. Can one, in such a self-portrait, omit something which affected one's whole being, and which one has thought of every day of one's life? Every day exaggerates, but not much. I do not need to recall Hartley. She is here. She is my end and my beginning. She is Alpha and Omega. I thought it better to draw a veil over this question, which was starting to worry me too much. I decided simply to write and to see if I could somehow approach, or find that I had approached, the vast subject of Hartley. And just as I found myself unexpectedly and spontaneously writing, "My paternal grandfather was a market gardener in Lincolnshire," so now I find that, wandering in my cavern, I have in fact come near to the great light source, and am ready to speak about my first love. But what can I say? I feel just as suddenly tongue-tied. My first love, and also my only love. All the best, even Clement, have been shadows by comparison. The necessity of this seems, in my own case, so great that I find it hard to imagine that it is not so with everyone.
On n'aime qu'une fois la première. Her name was Mary Hartley Smith. How quickly, readily, I write it down. Yet my heart beats fast, too. Oh, my God, Mary Hartley Smith. That is the heading of the story, then. But really I cannot tell the story. I will write some notes for the story and perhaps never tell it, or indeed it may be untellable since there are hardly any events in it, only feelings, the feelings of a child, of a youth, of a young man, nebulous and holy and stronger than anything in the whole of life. I can scarcely remember a time when I did not know Hartley. I went to a school for boys only, but the girls' school was nearby next door, and we saw the girls all the time. As there were a lot of Marys around in those days, she was always known as Hartley, and that was somehow very much her name. We paired off early on, but merrily, childishly, and without any deep, shaking emotions, as far as I can remember, in those earliest days. When we were about 12, the emotions began. They puzzled us, amazed us. They shook us as terriers shake rats. To say we were in love, that vague, weakened phrase, cannot express it. We loved each other. We lived in each other, through each other, by each other. We were each other. Why was it such pure, unadulterated pain? It is odd that I now write down, and will not change, the word pain. For of course what it was pure joy. Perhaps the point is that whatever it was extreme and pure. I am told that a blindfolded man cannot distinguish severe burning from severe freezing. Or perhaps at that age emotions tend to be felt as pains because they are not lightened by reflection. Everything becomes dread and fear, and the more wonderful and the more joyful, the more dread and the more fear. But let me repeat that this was not reflection, not thought. I did not harbour intelligent doubts about whether Hartley would go on loving me. Naturally, I knew that she was mine forever. But as we closed our eyes upon tears of joy, there was cosmic dread. Of course, and instinctively, we kept it all a secret. Our schoolfellows had got used to our playful friendship. Now we lay low. We were casual. We had secret meeting places. All this, as I say, was instinctive, never discussed or decided. We had to hide the precious thing in case it was hurt, derided, damaged, or offended in some way. My parents vaguely knew Hartley, of course, but she hardly ever came to the house, because of their almost morbid dislike of visitors, and also because I never suggested it. They did not suspect my special interest in her, because they regarded me then as much too young to have special interests. Her parents, equally vaguely aware of me, were equally uninterested, except that I think they rather disliked me. She had an elder brother who despised us both. Our world was sealed and secret. Parents would be duly informed later on when we got married. For, of course, we were going to marry when we were 18. We were the same age. There were many caresses, but we did not make love. Remember, this was long ago. I must try to describe Hartley. Oh, my darling, how clearly I can see you now. Surely this is perception, not imagination. The light in the cavern is daylight, not fire. Perhaps it is the only true light in my life, the light that reveals the truth. No wonder I feared to lose the light and to be left in the darkness forever. All a child's blind fear was there, the fear that my mother so early inspired in me, the kiss withheld, the candle taken. Hartley!
My Hartley. Yes, I see her clearly. Jumping over a rope, higher and higher it was raised. Hartley still flew over, the watchers sighing each time with sympathetic relief, and I hugging my heart in secret pride. She was the champion jumper of the school, of many schools, the champion runner, Hartley always first, and I cheering with the rest and laughing with secret joy. Hartley, in a breathless stillness, crouched upon a parallel bar, her bare thighs gleaming. The games master spoke of the Olympics. Come, Holy Ghost, our souls inspire, and lighten with celestial fire. We went out for confirmation together, to receive the divine blessing upon our love. I remember Hartley singing in church, her bright, innocent, lovely face raised up to the light, to God, towards the joy which belonged to her and which she must have. We talked a lot about religion. We talked a lot about everything, and we felt that we were dedicated people who would be protected by love. We experienced our innocence, and we did not think it would be difficult to be good. I can remember Hartley's marvellous laugh, but not that we teased each other much or were always making jokes. Ours was a solemn, holy happiness, and we shunned the coarser talk of our schoolfellows. I think we had little curiosity about sex. We were one, and only that mattered. We lived in paradise. We fled on bicycles to lie in buttercup fields, beside railway bridges, near canals, in wasteland awaiting housing estates. Ours was already a suburban countryside, but it was as lovely and significant to us as the Garden of Eden. She was not an intellectual or bookish girl. She had the wisdom of the innocents, and we conversed as angels. She was at home in time and space. I can see her smiling at me now. She was beautiful, but with a secret beauty. She was not one of the pretty girls of the school. Sometimes her face looked heavy, almost dour, and when she cried she looked like the pig baby in Alice. She was very pale, and people sometimes thought she looked ill, although she was so strong and so healthy. Her face was rather round and white, and her eyes gazed out with such a fey, puzzled look, like a young savage. She had dark blue eyes, which seemed to be violet when you were not looking at them. Her pupils were often dilated so that her eyes became almost black. She had very fine, straight, fair hair in a long bob. Her lips were pale and always cold, and when, with my eyes closing, I touched them so childishly with mine, a cold force pierced me like a spear, such as a pilgrim might feel when he knelt and touched some holy, life-renewing stone. Her body was passive to my embraces, but her spirit glowed to me with a cold fire. Her beautiful shoulders, her long legs were pale too, and seemed cold. I never saw her entirely undressed. She was slim, very slim, leggy and clean, and so strong. She never hugged me, but sometimes, rigidly, she held my arms, leaving great bruises. Her secret violet eyes did not close when I moved to kiss her. They stared with that strange puzzlement which was, at the same time, passion. Those quiet, silent, almost stiff embraces were the most passionate that I ever knew. And we were chaste, and respected each other absolutely, and worshipped each other chastely. And that was passion. And that was love of a purity which can never come again, and which I am sure rarely exists in the world at all. Those memories are more radiant to me than any work of art, more vivid and precious than Shakespeare or Piero della Francesca. There is a deep foundation of my being which knows not of time and change, and is still and ever with Hartley, in that good place where we once were. Having written this much, what can I say now? I could go on and on, simply describing Hartley. But it is becoming too painful. I lost her, the jewel of the world, and it remains a mystery to me to this day how that came about. A mystery concerning a young girl's soul and her life vision. I feared so many things, that she would die, or I would die, that we would be somehow cursed for being too happy. But I did not, at any rate in a conscious way, fear and envisage that which actually happened. Or were all my fears really of that? Only that was too terrible to bring to consciousness. Extreme love must bring terror with it, and great terror, like some kinds of prayer which lean upon the omniscience of the Almighty, has a vast, unlimited, all-embracing compass. So perhaps I did fear that, too. I must have cried in my incoherent heart, and that, let not that happen either, even though that seemed inconceivable. Let me try and put it down simply. And it is, of course, very simple. Hartley decided, when the time came, that she did not want to marry me. It was impossible to find out exactly why. I was too smashed by misery to think clearly, to question intelligently. She was confused, evasive, perhaps out of some desire to spare me pain, perhaps simply because of her own misery, perhaps because of some indecision which I stupidly failed to discern. She said certain terribly memorable things, but were these the reasons? Everything she said she seemed to efface afterwards in a fit of crying. We had said long ago that we would marry when we were 18, when we were grown up. How passionately, amid those mysterious, evasive, effacing tears, I cried out to her that I would wait. I would never hurry her. Was it a young girl's fear? I would respect it. She should do as she would, so long as she left us our precious future, with which we had lived for so long. Our marriage was a fixed and certain mark, and I only feared that I might die before I reached it. I went to London, to the drama school, with this fixed mark before me. We had still not told our parents. Perhaps this was my mistake. I was afraid of my mother's disapproval, of her opposition. She might say we were too young. I did not want yet to mar our happiness with parental rows, though we had so often said that we would outface any row. But if our parents had known and had agreed, or if we had done battle for our love, the very publicity of the plan would have made it more binding, more real. It would certainly have changed the atmosphere of our little paradise. Did I fear just this change, and did I lose her because I was a coward? Oh, what mistake did I make? What happened when I went to London? What went on in her mind? She had agreed, she had understood. Of course there was a separation, but I wrote every day. I came for weekends. She seemed unchanged. Then one day she told me. We had bicycled down to the canal, a way we often went. Our bicycles lay embraced together, as they always did, in the long grass beside the towing path. We walked on, looking at familiar things, dear things which we had made our own. It was autumn time. There were a lot of butterflies. Butterflies still remind me of those terrible minutes. She started to cry. I can't go on. I can't go on. I can't marry you. We wouldn't make each other happy. You wouldn't stay with me. You'd go away. You wouldn't be faithful. Yes, I love you, but I can't trust. I can't see. We were both demented with grief, and we cried out to each other in our grief. In despair, in death fear, I raved. At least we'll be friends forever. We can't leave each other. We can't lose each other. It's impossible. I should die. She shook her head, weeping. You know we can't be friends now. I can see her eyes glaring, her mouth wet with her tears, jerking. I never understood how she was able to be so strong. Did she mean what she said, or did the words conceal other words which she dared not say? Why had she changed her mind? I asked her and asked her. Why did she think I would not be faithful? Why did she think we would not be happy? Why could she no longer trust the future? I can't go on with it. I just can't. Had someone lied about me? Surely she could not be jealous about my life in London, where I did nothing but think about her. Clement, of course, was hidden in the future. Had she met someone else? No, 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 she said, and then she just repeated her terrible, incomprehensible words. Yes. She was very strong, and she escaped. I had to go back to London. After a day or two, I could not believe in the possibility of anything so dreadful. I wrote to her, commandingly, understandingly, confidently. I cancelled everything and ran back. I saw her again, and there was the same scene, and again. Then suddenly she was gone. I called at her house. Her parents, her brother, looked at me with hostility. She'd gone to stay with friends. They did not know the address. I called again the next week. Then I got a letter from her mother saying that Hartley did not want to see me and asking me not to pester them. I searched. I asked. I watched. How, in the 20th century, can people just vanish? Why is there not a register one can consult, a department one can write to? I spent my holidays on detective work. None of our school friends knew where she was. I put a notice in the local paper. I visited every place she had mentioned, everyone who had known her well. I wrote dozens of letters. Much later, of course, it was clear to me that she could only have escaped by running, by vanishing. Sometime during this period her parents left the district. Then I got a curt letter from her mother giving no address and saying that Hartley was married. I did not believe her. The parents were liars, a sinister influence. They hated me because Hartley loved me. I went on searching, I went on waiting. I felt that there must be some particular special cause for her flight, and that time would remove the cause and make things as they were. I conducted myself in such a wild, crazy manner that quite a lot of people came to know about my love, and I became quite famous as a mad lover. By then I wanted to advertise my plight, since someone might then bring me news. And someone did. Mr. McDowell wrote to me and said that it was true Hartley was married. I believed him. He gave no details, perhaps he feared I might commit some act of violence, and I asked for none. He said in his letter, "You must simply accept that she does not want you, that she loves someone else. With this no man can argue." Of course, I recovered, in a sense. I worked. I met Clement Macon and let her kidnap me. I told her the whole story, I think the first time I met her. I never told my parents, and I believe they never knew. They were such simple, unsuspicious people, and they never met anybody. Clement nursed me. She nursed my jealousy. It was a great topic between us for a while. She rather enjoyed it all. She felt she was curing me, and I let her think so, but she was mistaken. The wound was too deep, and now it was infected by the raging bitterness of jealousy. That awful leprosy came into my life when I read Mr. McDowell's letter, and has never left it since. She does not want you. She loves someone else. When I was searching for her, I was bemused by hope. I constantly forgave her in my heart, and this constantly renewed act of forgiveness brought me comfort. I felt that she must somehow know how I suffered, and that the antennae of my thought must touch her. But I always thought of her as alone. After I really understood that she was married, I did not hate her, but the demon of jealousy befouled the past and left my mind no place to rest. Jealousy is perhaps the most involuntary of all strong emotions. It steals consciousness. It lies deeper than thought. It is always there, like a blackness in the eye. It discolours the world. Hartley made a permanent metaphysical crisis of my life by refusing me for moral reasons. Did this lead me to make immorality my mask? Such pompous speculations are, of course, a kind of nonsense, and I surprise myself by writing them down. What were Hartley's reasons? I shall never know. It is possible that some demonic sense of a surrender of innocence entered into my affair with Clement, as if I were saying to Hartley, "You did not trust me. Well, I will show you now and forever after how right you were." Perhaps all my love affairs have been vicious attempts to show Hartley that she was right after all, but she was only right because she left me. You die at heart from a withdrawal of love. My mother's threats of such a withdrawal made me utterly vulnerable to Hartley's crime. Hartley destroyed my innocence, she and the demon of jealousy. She made me faithless. But with her I would have been faithful. With her my whole life would have been different, less rootless, less empty. Do I then think my life has been empty? My life? A ridiculous judgment. Could Hartley really have thought, the youth that I then was, a worldly man? If so, she was more like my mother than I ever suspected. She made me a worldly man by rejecting me. That failure ruined me morally. Did she think I would be lost in the theatre? She never said that. It was her rejection that made me lose my way. Would I have been faithful? How could I not have been if she had lived with me, sewed for me, cooked for me? We would have become one, and the holiness of marriage would have been our safety and our home forever. She was a part, an evidence of some pure, uncracked, unfissured confidence in the good which was never there for me again. Much later on, it was a little as if the past had recovered. The past can recover. I saw again, far away, like a dulled yet glowing painting of Adam and Eve upon an old fresco, two innocent beings bathed in a clear light. She became my Beatrice. As I went on, all the goodness of my life seemed to reside there with her. Goodness? Or was it just a very special blend of innocence and chaste passion? I have been able to write about her as she then was, and I am deeply glad to find that I can do it. There is that faint smell of fire and brimstone when something of the past comes tearing to the surface, vivid and complete. Of course, the whole of my life has been a tissue of memories of Hartley. But earlier on, I think I could not have written these things down, or admitted that, in her despite and in mine, that ancient love is somehow still alive. Of course, I never saw her again. In the years to come, I thanked God that the demon of jealousy itself had warned me not to find out any details. The suffering would have been too great, and I never even knew her married name. I stopped searching. I did not want to know where she was dragging out her obscure existence. I did not want my circling thought to have names and places to feed upon. But it pleased me to think of her life as dull. And then, when I became well-known, and my name was often in the papers, it pleased me to imagine that she felt terrible secret pangs of remorse and regret, and that a bitter worm gnawed her as painfully as it has gnawed me. She threw away her happiness when she threw away mine. I would have made her a queen in this world. Ever since those terrible days, I have feared the possibility of an overwhelmingly powerful pain source in my life, and I have nursed myself so as not to suffer too much. Possibly this is the deep reason why I have not married. What a queer gamble our existence is. We decide to do A instead of B, and then the two roads diverge utterly and may lead in the end to heaven and to hell. Only later one sees how much and how awfully the fates differ. Yet what were the reasons for the choice? They may have been forgotten. Did one know what one was choosing? Certainly not. There are such chasms of might-have-beens in any human life. When I was confirmed, I was determined to be good forever, and I still feel a ghostly illusion that I could have been. The image of Hartley changed in my mind from fiery pain to sadness, but never became blank. And in a way, I did keep on searching for her. Only it was a different and quite involuntary kind of search, a sort of dream search. It was as if in my persisting memory of her I seemed to body her forth, the ways she moved, the ways she walked, as if a physical scheme of her being kept me always company. And so, and especially as the pain faded, I kept seeing her, seeing shadow forms of her imposed upon quite different women. Her shoulders, her hair, her walk, her puzzled fey expression. I still sometimes see these shadows. I saw one lately upon an old woman in the village, a transient look of her head placed like a mask upon somebody entirely different. Once or twice in London, long ago, I even followed these ghosts, not because I thought they were she, but simply to torment myself, to punish myself for still remembering. A little while ago the thought came to me that she was dead. That strange pallor, those dilated pupils. Perhaps these were presages of disease, of some quiet killer biding its time. Perhaps, really, she had died long ago when I was still young. In a way, I would be glad to know that she was dead. What would my love for her do then? Would it peacefully die too, or be transformed into something selfless and innocent? Would jealousy, the jealousy which has burned even in these pages, leave me at last, and the smell of fire and brimstone fade away? Even now I shake and tremble as I write. Memory is too weak a name for this terrible evocation. Oh, Hartley, Hartley, how timeless, how absolute love is! My love for you is unaware that I am old. and you, perhaps, are dead. I ate 3 oranges at 11 o'clock this morning. Oranges should be eaten in solitude and as a treat when one is feeling hungry. They are too messy and overwhelming to form part of an ordinary meal. I should say here that I am not a breakfast eater, though I respect those who are. I breakfast on delicious Indian tea. Coffee and China tea are intolerable at breakfast time, and for me, coffee, unless it is very good and made by somebody else, is pretty intolerable at any time. It seems to me an inconvenient and much overrated drink. But this I will admit to be a matter of personal taste, whereas other views which I hold on the subject of food approximate to absolute truths. I do not normally eat at breakfast time, since even half a slice of buttered toast can induce an inconvenient degree of hunger, and eating too much breakfast is a thoroughly bad start to the day. I am, however, not at all averse to elevenses, which can come in great variety. There are, as indicated above, moments for oranges. There are also moments for chilled port and plum cake. The orange feast did not dim my appetite for lunch, which consisted of fish cakes with hot Indian pickle, and a salad of grated carrot, radishes, watercress, and bean shoots. I went through a period of grated carrot with everything, but recovered. Then cherry cake with ice cream. I had mixed feelings about ice cream until I realized that it must always be eaten with a cake or tart, never with fruit alone. By itself, it is, of course, pointless, even if stuffed with nuts or other rubbish. And by ice cream, I mean the creamy vanilla sort. Flavoured ice cream is as repugnant to the purist as flavoured yoghurt. Nor have I ever been able to see the raison d'etre of the so-called water ice, which transforms itself offensively on the tongue from a searing lump of hard, frozen material into a mouthful of equally tasteless water. I am grieved that my lack of a refrigerator involves me in a marginal waste of food. My refrigeratorless mother never wasted a crumb. Everything not consumed lived to fight another day. How we loved her bread puddings! I have reread what I wrote about Hartley, and feel moved simply by the fact that I was able to write it. It is but a shadowy tribute. If I can bear to write more on the subject, I may try to improve it. How strange memory is! Since I wrote, so many more pictures of her, stored up in the dense darkness of my mind, have become available. Her long legs bicycling, her bare dusty feet in sandals, her lithe movement from crouching to standing, balanced upon the parallel bar in the gym display. The feel of her strong hands through my shirt holding on to my shoulders. We did not caress each other in an immodest way. Our burning youth was docile to the chivalry of a pure passion. We were prepared to wait. Alas, and alas! Never so pure and gentle, never so intense did it come to me after, that absolute and holy yearning of one human body and soul for another. But reading my story, I feel again the terrible mystery of it. When did she start to turn away? Did she deceive me? Oh, why did it happen? I spent the afternoon tidying the house. I carried 2 dustbins to the end of the causeway. I note with displeasure that the dustmen last time let some rubbish fall down onto the rocks below. I have had to climb down and collect it. I cleaned the kitchen and washed the huge black slates of the floor. They are worthy of a cathedral. A man came to deliver Caligas cylinders, rather to my surprise. I had mentioned the matter in the fishermen's stores. I must remember to inquire if they can supply a Caligas fridge. The remainder of the ice cream has melted. My larder is still damp. I have lit a fire in the little red room and left the downstairs doors open. I moved quite a lot of wood into the downstairs inner room, where I hope it will get dry. I am getting used to the smell of wood smoke, which now pervades the house. It has stopped raining and the sun is shining, but over most of the sea the sky is a thick leaden grey. The sunny golden rocks stand out against that dark background. What a paradise! I shall never tire of this sea and this sky. If I could only carry a chair and table over the rocks to the tower, I could sit and write there with the view of Raven Bay. I must go out and study my rock pools while this intense light lasts. I think I'm becoming more observant. I lately noticed a colony of delightful, very small crabs, like little transparent yellow grapes, and some ferocious-looking tiny fish with whiskers which resemble miniature coelacanths. I feel calmer now already about Hartley, as if the thought of her has been somehow mercifully absorbed into the sane, open air of my home. This is indeed a test of my new environment. "You'll go mad with loneliness and boredom," they said. All my instincts were right. I would like to tell all these things to someone. Perhaps to Lizzie. I left in store with that first love so much of my innocence and gentleness which I later destroyed and denied, and which is yet now perhaps at last available again. Can a woman's ghost, after so many years, open the doors of the heart? History. 1. I did not look at the crabs, after all. I became obsessed with the idea of carrying a chair and table out to the tower, and I set off across the rocks with a little folding table which I had moved from the middle room to the drawing room. This object soon began to seem absurdly heavy, and I found to my annoyance that the smooth, steep faces of the rocks were too difficult to climb while I was holding the table in one hand. Eventually I let the thing fall into a crevasse. I must try to pioneer some easier way to get to the tower. I climbed onward and sat on a wet rock overlooking Raven Bay. The sun was still shining and the seaward sky was still grey. The smooth, foamless sea was rising and falling against the rocks with a gentle, inviting rhythm. The longer shadows made the big spherical stones of the bay stand out, half dark, half gleaming. The long, quite pretty facade of the Raven Hotel showed very clear and detailed in the odd, brilliant light. I was just getting over my annoyance about the table when I noticed a man walking along the road in the direction of Shrough End, having just turned the corner from the bayside. He was dressed in a smart suit and a trilby hat, and looked in that vivid landscape like an incongruous figure in a surrealist picture. I surveyed his oddity. Walkers on that road were even rarer than cars. Then he began to look familiar. Then I recognized him. Gilbert Opium. My first instinct was to hide, and in fact I moved into the moist, salt-smelling interior of the tower, under the bright round of sky, feeling a small unpleasant shock. However, I could not seriously regard Gilbert as a menacing figure, and it then occurred to me that of course he was bringing Lizzie. So I hurried out again and began to scramble over the rocks in the direction of the road. By the time I reached the tarmac, Gilbert had seen me and turned back. We met each other, he smiling. Gilbert was wearing a lightweight black suit with a striped shirt and flowery tie. When he saw me, he took off his hat. It was 3 or 4 years since I had seen Gilbert, and he had aged a lot. The mysterious, awful changes which alter the human face from youth to age may gently dally and delay, then act decisively all at once. Gilbert in young middle age looked rosy and boyish. Now he was all wrinkled and humorous and dry, with that faint air of quizzical cynicism which clever elderly people often instinctively put on, and which may be quite new to them, a final defence. When I last saw him, he still wore a fresh, unself-conscious air of childish conceit. Now his face was full of wary, watchful anxiety, masquerading as worldly detachment, as if he were cautiously trying out his new wrinkles as a mask. Though podgier, he still contrived to look handsome, and his white, curly hair still had a jaunty look, had not learnt to seem old. I was wearing jeans and a white shirt which had escaped from them. Seeing Gilbert's tie, his tie-pin, his, or was I mistaken, discreet make-up, I felt a quick, contemptuous pity for him, together with a sense of how fit I was, how hard. I could see Gilbert taking these things in, the pity, the fitness. His moist, light-blue, faintly pinkish eyes flickered anxiously between their dry layers of wrinkles.
"Darling! You look marvellous! So brown, so young! My God, your complexion!"
Gilbert always speaks in a rich, fruity, ringing voice, as if addressing the back of the stalls. Have you brought Lizzie?
No.
A letter? Message?
Not exactly.
What, then?
Is that funny-looking house yours?
Yes.